From Pacifica, this is Democracy Now!
It is very sad to see a crowded Palestinian camp hijacked by an extreme elements, because the intention of the Palestinian worldwide is to bring, like, you know, support from different countries and from people worldwide. But to see an extreme elements affiliated with Al-Qaeda hijacking and attacking the Lebanese army, this is really not justified.
Veteran Arab journalist Zaki Shahab grew up in a Palestinian refugee camp in Lebanon. He'll join us to talk about the continued fighting near Tripoli and about his new book, Inside Hamas, The Untold Story of the Militant Islamic Movement.
It is fair to say that Hamas won the election through a fair process. But it's also wise to say that Hamas, over the last year, since they won their victory, have made mistakes similar to the mistakes Fatah have made over the last 10 years.
Then Rick MacArthur, publisher of Harper's Magazine, on a secret trade deal made between Democrats and Republicans in the House. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The Lebanese army is continuing to shell a refugee camp near Tripoli that houses over 40,000 Palestinians. For the past 3 days, the camp's been under siege as Lebanese troops have battled with gunmen from the group Fatah al-Islam. At least 79 people have died since Sunday in the bloodiest internal fighting since the end of Lebanon's civil war. Palestinian sources in the camp said the civilian deaths could rise as rescue workers have not been able to reach some of the wounded. Food, water, and aid supplies are running out inside the camp. The fighting began after members of Fatah al-Islam robbed a bank on Sunday. The Lebanese government accuses the group of having ties with al-Qaeda and the Syrian government, but the group denies the accusations. On Monday, Palestinian leaders in Lebanon called for a ceasefire. This is Ali Shaban of the Palestinian Islamic Jihad.
Palestinian groups and factions call on the Lebanese army to halt its policy of chaotic shelling, which has destroyed houses and killed and wounded 50 civilians.
Meanwhile, in Washington, State Department spokesperson Sean McCormick says the Bush administration supports the actions of the Lebanese government.
Lebanese armed forces are doing an admirable job in working on behalf of the Lebanese government and the Lebanese people to try to bring law and order back to this area of Lebanon. And it's well within their rights to do so.
There has also been sporadic violence in Beirut. Last night, a bomb exploded, injuring 10 people. Congressional Democrats have reportedly decided to make a major concession to President Bush over the war in Iraq. According to the Associated Press, Democrats intend to draft an Iraq war funding bill without a timeline for the withdrawal of U.S. troops. It would provide funds for military operations in Iraq through September 30th. The bill also includes the first federal increase in the minimum wage in over a decade. The Democrats made the concession on the war funding after President Bush vetoed an earlier bill because Democrats included a timetable for the withdrawal of U.S. troops. Presidential candidate John Edwards criticized congressional Democrats for compromising with President Bush. Edwards said in a statement, quote, "Congress should send him the same bill back to him again and again until he realizes he has no choice but to start bringing our troops home." In Iraq, at least 25 people died earlier today when a car bomb exploded in a packed outdoor market in southwestern Baghdad. Another 60 people were injured. Meanwhile, the U.S. military is planning to make a major push into the Baghdad neighborhood of Sadr City that houses 2 million Shiites. The Washington Post reports the U.S. military is considering a wholesale clearing of the neighborhood if political avenues fail. One military officer said, quote, "A second Fallujah plan exists, but we don't want to execute it." In other news from Iraq, the British journalist Patrick Coburn has revealed explosive details about a secret U.S. plan to kill or capture one of Iraq's best-known Shiite leaders, Muqtada al-Sadr. According to Coburn, the U.S. Army tried to carry out the plan 2.5 years ago by luring al-Sadr to peace negotiations at a house in the holy city of Najaf. Iraq's national security advisor said the effects of the U.S. plan is still being felt because it led to Sadr losing all confidence and trust in the U.S. On Capitol Hill, the Senate has voted to move ahead with a debate to overhaul the nation's immigration laws, but the proposal is already facing widespread criticism. Last week, a bipartisan group of senators outlined a proposal that quickly received the support of President Bush. The Senate leadership had hoped the bill would be passed this week, but it has been met by unexpected opposition from both the left and right. The actual vote on the immigration proposal has now been pushed off till June. The Senate proposal calls for increased border security, a temporary guest worker program, and a provision that would give legal status to some of the undocumented immigrants living in the United States. The proposal would also create a point system for future immigration to de-emphasize family ties in favor of educational attainment and work skills. In environmental news, the United States is battling to stop world leaders at next month's G8 meeting from pushing for urgent talks and a new deal to fight global warming. Reuters is reporting the Bush administration wants to delete references in G8 documents that describe the urgency of the climate crisis and that call for a new UN conference on the issue. The United States is trying to get the following paragraph deleted from G8 documents. It reads, quote, "We firmly agree that resolute and concerted international action is urgently needed in order to reduce global greenhouse gas emissions and sustain our common basis of living." The Bush administration has also objected to most references to targets and timetables to cut climate warming carbon emissions. This includes an effort by Germany to get rich nations to agree to cut energy consumption by 20% by 2020 and raise energy efficiency in transport and power generation by the same amount over the same period. Meanwhile, in related news, a team of international scientists reported Monday worldwide carbon dioxide levels have taken a sudden and alarming jump since the year 2000. The scientists found that CO2 emissions from fossil fuels are increasing at three times the rate experienced in the 1990s. Israel is threatening to intensify its attacks on the Hamas leadership following a rocket attack on Monday that killed an Israeli woman. This is Israeli Foreign Minister Tzipi Livni.
The Palestinian government, headed by Hamas terrorist organization responsible for the situation, and this unacceptable situation must be stopped. Until now, Israel has shown restraint, but the rockets and the Qassam missiles on the road and the attacks continued. Israel must defend its citizens.
High-ranking Israeli officials are now threatening to assassinate members of the Hamas political leadership. Deputy Defense Minister Ephraim Sneh hinted today that Israel might even target Palestinian Prime Minister Ismail Haniyeh as part of an effort to stop the rocket attacks. Earlier today, the Israeli military sealed off Gaza and the West Bank ahead of the Jewish holiday of Shavuot. The United Nations humanitarian chief, John Holmes, is urging the international community not to turn its back on Somalia at a time of desperate need. Holmes said the U.S.-backed Somali government appears to be seriously underestimating the humanitarian suffering in the country. Holmes testified before the U.N. Security Council Monday. He says almost 400,000 Somalis fled Mogadishu following the U.S.-backed Ethiopian invasion and that the vast majority of people have not returned home. Newsweek's reported some refugees have resorted to renting trees for shelter. Meanwhile, aid workers in Somalia have described a dire situation inside the few medical clinics set up. This is Matthias Fries of the International Committee of the Red Cross.
We are doing a distribution of food for displaced families from Mogadishu. We are addressing about 800, 900 families in this town. The families, the people fled from Mogadishu recently because of the heavy fightings, and here they are seeking protection by their clan.
The head of one of Somali Red Crescent clinics said many of the refugees are suffering from malnutrition.
There are 25 to 30 people who come every day, mainly displaced people from Mogadishu. Their main problem is watery diarrhea and malnutrition. Our medical stock is decreasing faster than usual, and this affects our supply chain.
The Virginian Pilot newspaper is reporting the private security company Blackwater USA has succeeded in partially derailing a landmark lawsuit brought by the families of four Blackwater employees killed in Fallujah, Iraq, 3 years ago. A federal judge has ordered the lawsuit to be decided behind closed doors in arbitration. This will allow Blackwater to avoid public examination of its practices in Iraq. The outcome of the arbitration will be confidential. One of the three arbitrators is William Webster. He served as head of the FBI and CIA under President Reagan and has personal and business ties to several Blackwater lawyers. Iran has charged a prominent American scholar of trying to topple the Iranian government. The scholar, Hala Isfandiari, was imprisoned in Iran on May 8th after more than 4 months under virtual house arrest. She's the director of the Middle East program at the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars. The Wilson Center said the charges against Isfandiari had no foundation. Isfandiari is a dual U.S. and Iranian citizen. She went to Iran last year to take care of her 93-year-old mother. Her arrest has been widely condemned in the academic world. In political news, New Mexico Governor Bill Richardson officially declared his candidacy for the Democratic presidential nomination. He's attempting to become the nation's first Latino president. Richardson made the announcement in both English and Spanish during a speech in Los Angeles.
We need a president who is not dismissive of diplomacy, but someone who embraces it as the primary instrument of our foreign policy, because he has practiced it and knows how to get results.
Bill Richardson served as Secretary of Energy and Ambassador to the United Nations during the Clinton administration. There are new developments in the student loan industry scandal. The financial aid directors at Johns Hopkins and Columbia Universities have been forced out of their posts amid revelations they received payments or gifts from loan companies they recommended to students. Columbia's David Charlo is said to have held more than $100,000 in stock from the company Student Loan Express. The same lending company paid Ellen Frischberg at Johns Hopkins $65,000. And this news is in from London. British prosecutors have charged a former KGB agent in the poisoning death of Russian dissident Alexander Litvinenko. The British government said Andrei Lugovoy met with Litvinenko at the London hotel only hours before Litvinenko became ill with polonium-210 poisoning. Litvinenko was a former spy and prominent critic of the Russian government. The Russian prosecutor general's office has announced it will not turn Lugovoy over to Britain to be tried. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Lebanese tanks and artillery are continuing to shell a Palestinian refugee camp near Tripoli for a third day amidst growing concerns for the 40,000 civilians trapped inside. The Nahr al-Barad camp has been under siege since Sunday as Lebanese troops have battled with gunmen from the group Fatah al-Islam. The Lebanese government accuses the group of having ties with al-Qaeda and the Syrian government. Syria denies any involvement. At least 80 people have been killed in the fighting, making it Lebanon's worst internal violence since the end of the civil war 17 years ago. As the Lebanese army continues to fire on the densely populated refugee camp, it's preventing any of the residents from leaving. Aid organizations have been unable to enter the camp and voice fears of a mounting humanitarian crisis. Doctors inside have called for a ceasefire because of the dead and wounded lying on the streets. Electricity supplies have been cut, and there is limited food and water. The United States, which backs the Beirut government, said Lebanon was justified in attacking the militants. President Bush said, quote, extremists that are trying to topple that young democracy need to be reined in. The fighting began after members of Fatah al-Islam robbed a bank Sunday. Meanwhile, in Beirut, two separate bomb attacks over the past 2 nights left one person dead and 17 injured. We turn now to our guest, Zaki Shahab. He's written the book Inside Hamas, The Untold Story of the Militant Islamic Movement. He is the political editor of the London-based Al Hayat newspaper and the Arabic TV channel LBC. For over 25 years, he's covered Middle Eastern conflicts as a commentator for the Arab and Western media. He is a Palestinian born in a refugee camp in Lebanon. Welcome to Democracy Now!
It's a pleasure to be with you.
It's good to have you with us. Let's begin on Lebanon. We hope to get a report directly from there, but you grew up there. How far from this camp?
In fact, I was born in the south of the country, and this specific camp where the fighting is taking place is right up in the north. And it's very sad to hear the news that a 40,000 population of this camp, who live practically in a lined camp with like length 2 kilometer, width 1 kilometer, and nothing to be proud of, to see such a group trying to rob a bank, going into fighting with Lebanese army. Because at the end of the day, this is nothing to do with the Palestinian cause. This is really harming the population. And it would raise the question, why Palestinian factions still holding weapons in Palestinian camps in Lebanon? We should be treated as other camps in Syria, Jordan, Egypt, anywhere. Palestinians should allow the Lebanese government, the Lebanese army, to take control of their territory.
Let's go directly to the camp. Nicholas Blandford is on the line with us, correspondent for the Christian Science Monitor. He's with a UN aid convoy just outside Nahr al-Bared camp. Welcome to Democracy Now, Nicholas.
Hello there. Nice to be with you.
Can you describe what you see right now, Nicholas?
Right, I'm on the southern edge of the camp. We were trying to follow a UN humanitarian convoy into the camp. There's a ceasefire in place, but it's extremely shaky. So we were just driving to the entrance of the camp, and there was the machine gun fire, and it was coming from behind us near an army position. I'm not quite sure what's going on, but there's a possibility that some of the militants slipped out of the camp and were working their way around to the first army checkpoint. So the scene is quite chaotic at the moment. There are a lot of soldiers running around, looking through. There's very thick vegetation between us and the sea, which is about 300-400 yards away, and that vegetation of bamboo plantations, banana groves, and so on, goes all the way up to the camp and provides good cover if any of the militants want to sneak out and attack the soldiers.
What sense do you have of the level of casualties?
Well, we've just been talking to, because there is a ceasefire, there are some cars coming out of the camp at the moment. They're individual cars crammed full of people. They're waving white flags out of the window. We've just been talking to some of them. They say the situation in the camp is extremely serious. There are many dead under the rubble of bombed-out buildings. They're all extremely angry and upset with Fatah al-Islam. They say that they're not Palestinians, that they're foreigners, and they have nothing to do with them. They say that Fatah al-Islam have been shooting at vehicles trying to leave, and there is a demonstration on in the camp now. They're taking advantage of the ceasefire to come out from the streets. Over 300 people, one woman told us, to basically demand the Fatah al-Islam to leave, because it's the Palestinian population in the camp that's suffering.
Are people being allowed out, Nicholas?
They're being allowed out now because I think really they're just taking advantage of the ceasefire, but it's fairly chaotic, and I've been here about half an hour on the edge of the camp, and there's maybe 10, 12 cars only have come out, each car full of people, so maybe 50 people altogether. But you're talking about a camp which has a population of around 40,000 crammed into a tiny, small area. And most of them, of course, aren't able to get out at the moment.
Is aid getting in?
I'm sorry, say again?
Is aid getting in to the camp?
Well, we watched the UN aid convoy head into the camp. We weren't allowed to follow them any further. So one assumes that they've managed to reach the camp safely. There were four trucks filled with medical supplies and food, and there was a water tank as well, and also a large generator, because the camp has been cut off. There's been no electricity there since Sunday when the fighting broke out. The people are telling us they've run out of food and they've run out of water, and they're hiding in the rubble of their bombed-out houses, praying just for any opportunity to get out.
What is your sense of who the militants are, and what is the attitude of the people in the camp toward them?
Well, they're extremely angry towards them, judging from what people are telling us as they come out of the camp. They say that they're not real Palestinians. They say that they are Syrians and Iraqis. One woman said there are Afghanis among them, people from Jordan, from Saudi Arabia. They said, we don't really know anything about these people. We don't know where they came from, why they're here. So there's a lot of hostility, and also there's a lot of anger and resentment as well at the fact that they've been caught up, the civilians in the camp have been caught up in this confrontation between the Lebanese army and Fatah al-Islam. So, of course, the bulk of the casualties are from Lebanese army shelling of the camp, and it's quiet now, but it has been very heavy in the past, yesterday afternoon, when you could watch from the high ground above the camp and see the mortar shells being fired from the Lebanese army positions, exploding from one end of the camp to the other, setting buildings afire and causing, I'm sure, very widespread damage down there.
We're talking to Nicholas Blandford, correspondent for the Christian Science Monitor, with the UN aid convoy just outside of the Nahr al-Bared camp. Timur Göksel, a former spokesperson for the UN peacekeeping force in Lebanon, says the outbreak of heavy fighting is just an incident and not the start of a new wave of violence. Do you agree with this assessment, Nicholas?
Yes, I do. I know Timur Göksel very well. He's been around Lebanon much longer than I have, so he has a very good intuition on these things. I do believe this is an isolated incident. There isn't a nationwide support by any means for these militants. There is some local support in North Lebanon among some of the more extremist Islamists up here. But it's a very small support, and it really doesn't presage a greater upswell of violence around the country. But it's very vicious what's going on, and very unpleasant, but it is pretty much localized to the camp.
Some are reporting, I'm looking at Salon right now, Nicholas, the fugitive leader of the shadowy militant organization Fatah Islam openly embraces Osama bin Laden and has recruited Arab fighters to carry out attacks around the region. Is this your understanding?
Well, we've been hearing from soldiers on the ground here that the militants are threatening to fire rockets and mortar shells into nearby Tripoli. Tripoli is Lebanon's second largest city, and it's about 9 miles south of the camp. But that places it within range of some of the rockets, Katyusha rockets that these militants are believed to have, which have a range of around 12 miles. They've also threatened to bombard neighboring areas a little bit closer to the camp, civilian areas. But so far, the fighting hasn't expanded to that sort of distance from the camp. The militants have been shelling Lebanese army positions. They clearly have mortars and apparently are very well armed. But if they start to bombard Tripoli, then that really will escalate the situation quite considerably.
Do you believe they're tied to Syria?
I'm sorry, say again.
Do you believe they are tied to Syria?
Well, this is a group with a very murky background, and it really depends on whom you talk to in Lebanon as to what origins they will say for the group. Essentially, the Lebanese government and the anti-Syrian politicians in Lebanon believe that Fatah al-Islam, yes, it's an Islamist organization, yes, it has links to Osama bin Laden and follows his ideology, but it is, in fact, placed in Lebanon by Syrian military intelligence as a means of causing instability in the country. Then there are others who say, well, the anti-Syrian politicians in Lebanon blame Syria for everything, and there's no evidence that these guys are, in fact, being manipulated by the Syrians. So the jury is out, and it really depends on whom you talk to here as to the sort of the different views that you'll hear about these people.
Nicholas Blandford, I want to thank you for being with us, correspondent for the Christian Science Monitor, with a UN aid convoy just outside of the Nahr al-Bared camp. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. When we come back, we continue our conversation with Zaki Shahab, the political editor of the London-based Al Hayat and LBC TV channel, and author of the new book called Inside Hamas. Stay with us. من كل الغصون الزائفة وأعري شجر الزيتون من كل الغصون الزائفة فإذا كنت أغني للفتاة
أجفان العيون الخائفة فإذا كنت أغني للفرح خلف أجفان العيون الخائفة فلأن العاصفة وعدتني بنبيذ وبأنخاب جديدة وبأقواس قزح ولأن العاصفة وعدتني بنبيذ وبأنخاب جديدة وبأقواس قزح ولأن العاصفة كنست صوت العصافير البليدة والغصون المستعارة.
Promises of the storm, Marcel Khalifa. Here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. We're broadcasting on over 500 stations around the country, on Pacifica and NPR stations, low-power FM, college and community radio stations, on public access TV and PBS TV stations, and both TV satellite networks, on Dish Network Channel 9415 Free Speech TV, 9410 Link TV, and on DirecTV Channel 375. We're also broadcasting and podcasting at democracynow.org. Video and audio and our headlines are in Spanish and audio and transcript form. As we turn back to Zaki Shahab, the political editor of the London-based Al-Hayat newspaper and the Arabic TV channel LBC, his latest book is Inside Hamas, The Untold Story of the Militant Islamic Movement. But staying on Lebanon for a minute, the description Nicholas Blanford just gave inside the camp, you, someone who grew up in the camps of Lebanon.
Nicholas' statement or whatever he said about the situation right in front of the camp is completely true, because what he said, that people in the camp already have they taken advantage of the ceasefire to go out and demonstrate against this extreme militant group. It's so easy for someone who have the money and the arms just to take a corner in the camp, hijack it, and just fight with the others. It's a gang. It shouldn't really use the Palestinian name, because it's against. The Palestinian in Lebanon are law-abiding citizens, and the Lebanese authority have the right to go everywhere in Lebanon. So, there is no need for the weapons in the camp, and we should not, step into and meddle with the situation in Lebanon. Lebanon have suffered enough. Lebanon have given the Palestinian more than any other Arab country have given us. And it's time now that we should give up our weapons and try to help this democracy and democratic process in Lebanon to prevail.
You grew up in a camp near Tyre. Why are the camps there? And what is it like to grow up in a Palestinian refugee camp?
The Palestinians who came to Lebanon, they came as a result of 1948 and Israeli occupation. My parents were forced to flee their villages in the north of the country, north of Palestine. And till today, they're still waiting for a solution. They're still waiting for a just solution who would give Palestinians, a hope that they will have an independent state, a solution for their problems in the diaspora. That's the kind of conflicts we are suffering. And as soon as this problem is continuing, extreme elements, terrorists will take advantage of the poor Palestinians, the desperate Palestinians, send some money and weapons to groups like Fatah al-Islam, and then you can see what kind of disturbance they can cause to Lebanese, to Palestinians, and to worldwide.
I want to turn now to the situation in the occupied territories. Israel warned Hamas today that none of its leaders are safe from attack following a rocket fired from Gaza on Monday that killed an Israeli woman. The Israeli military carried out two new air raids in Gaza overnight in response to the attack. Israel's pounded Hamas targets in Gaza for nearly a week, killing more than 30 people. High-ranking Israeli officials are now threatening to assassinate the Hamas leadership. Public Security Minister Avi Dichter said Israel will kill exiled Hamas leader Khaled Meshaal, quote, at the first opportunity, and warned Prime Minister Ismail Haniyeh of Hamas could also be targeted. Zaki Shahab, you've just published Inside Hamas, The Untold Story of the Militant Islamic Movement. Talk about what's happening today.
Nothing in the statements made by Israeli officials and ministers is new. They have all along been targeting Hamas leaders, killing them. Israel did not stop one day. They have killed the founder of Hamas. They have killed his deputy. They've killed so many leaders.
Every day. And you've interviewed all of them.
I interviewed all of them. I met them, and I don't think it will affect the way Hamas functioning. I think it's time that Israel would think again or rethink, because 14 years of negotiation with the Palestinians have achieved nothing. Resorting to violence and military force is not going to solve Israel's problem. The only thing would solve Israel's problem is by giving Palestinian hope, by withdrawing fully from West Bank and Gaza, by giving the Palestinians the right and the freedom to move around. Give them the chance to live in dignity. This is the only way which give peace and security to Israel and the Israelis.
Zaki Shahab, let's go back to the beginning of Hamas, as you do in this book. How was it created?
Hamas practically is a branch of the International Islamic Brotherhood movement worldwide. As I was told by Sheikh Yassin himself, the founder of Hamas, till 1977, himself, he was not a member of the Islamic Brotherhood movement. He visited Egypt for the first time, and he met some of their leaders at that time as someone who admired them, but practically he was not a member. So Hamas as an organization was practically or officially launched in the first week of the Intifada in 1987. But as they were active like as a group, and you would be surprised if I tell you that the Israeli government at that time have helped Hamas to expand. They have given them the permission to set up social centers, and the what's so-called the nerve center for the Hamas movement today, the Islamic University, is something have been given by the Israelis to Hamas to weaken Fatah, who was fighting the Israelis at that time. So in terms of military struggle against Israel, Hamas till 1987 never been involved with a military struggle with Israel, unlike Fatah, who have started this in the 60s.
So you're saying that the Israeli government helped set up Hamas?
It's not only that. Even the first cache of weapon Hamas managed to accumulate, it was given to them by the Shin Bet, which is like the homeland security or the Israeli internal intelligence. To the extent that when Hamas founder Ahmad Yassin and his fellow were arrested, they were convicted as a result of the cache weapon given to them by the Israelis, and to be specific, by someone who have like carried the name of Abu Sabri.
And Yassin and Rantisi have both been assassinated.
Both of them has been assassinated.
By the Israelis.
By the Israelis, yes. It was very clear from day one. And I think, you know, whatever measures Israel takes against Hamas leader, the experience have showed us that there are always someone who would take place and replace, and nothing would really change the situation. The only thing which can weaken Hamas is by giving the Palestinian hope that there will be an independent state at a specific time.
So you're saying that Israel set up Hamas to counter Arafat?
To counter Fatah and Arafat leadership at that time, who was like, you know, involved in a heavy fighting and struggle with Israel. As you know, Fatah was like the main force behind the Intifada, behind force again, you know, behind the attacks which have taken against Israel. So that's practically the intention, because the Islamic movement at that time was quite conservative, shy, and not organized. And the Israelis, as I've been told by even Israeli leaders who were active in the what's so-called the civil administration, which was set up straight after the occupation of Gaza and West Bank in 1967, that they were trying to find organization and personalities who would like became more active and take the popularity away from Fatah and other moderate and left groups.
What do you make of the reports that Americans are now arming Fatah to fight Hamas, to undermine and replace the Palestinian Unity Government? This is really
nonsense. And I can give you an example. The latest approval of the Congress of $19 million, which has been mentioned in the media that it's dedicated to strengthen Mahmoud Abbas or Fatah military wing and the president security guards. The fact that this $19 million, Mahmoud Abbas himself have found out that nearly $15 million of this money would be spent by Americans, either on travel or equipments or cars or how to spend. So practically, the money which would reach the Palestinian Authority would not be more than 3 to 4 million, to the extent that Mahmoud Abbas himself was considering writing a letter to the Congress to tell them, thank you, we don't need your money. So the kind of impression when a Congress approved such amount would go in the media as if the Americans are, you know, financing and funding in this way. The fact that there are peace agreements signed in 1993, these agreements have allowed the Palestinian Authority to receive weapon and the training so they can arm their police and security services. But since 1993, more than 13 years, Israel have not allowed the Palestinian Authority to upgrade the weaponry. And the kind of weakness they are under and suffering from is a result of what Israel is doing, because there's no respect for the agreements.
The issue of the PLO, of Hamas recognizing Israel.
It's quite an interesting question. Everyone would ask, you know, why Hamas would not recognize Israel. It's a very clear question. But I would ask, you know, what Israel would give Hamas in exchange for this? You know, when someone want to get married, he would ask his fiancé if she's going to be loyal to him, faithful, not going out, respectful, all sorts of things. And she would ask him if he snores and, you know, made certain conditions, because she will say, yes, I will marry you, or he will say, I will marry, you know, you as well. So Israel would jump straight and ask for marriage straight away. Israel have to give the Palestinian, you know, concrete promises that by this specific time, if Hamas would recognize the state of Israel, then we would give you an independent Palestinian state. There are major Palestinian groups, and including Fatah, have recognized Israel for the last 14 years. Unfortunately, this recognition, the tens of peace agreements which were signed in Washington, in Cairo, in Oslo, and all over the world, have not achieved peace with Israel, because the Israelis been very mean in giving the Palestinian the hope they needed so they can have peace and proper peace for them and for the Israelis. So the kind of commitment was not fulfilled, to the extent that in the last meeting between Mahmoud Abbas and Prime Minister Olmert, Olmert asked Mahmoud Abbas why Hamas did not commit itself to the peace agreement signed with Israel. And Abbas joked with Olmert. He told him, are you yourself committed to the peace agreements we signed with you? So this is really the kind of atmosphere and situation. Far from this, the last 2 months, we have seen the most important accord reached between Fatah and Hamas in Saudi Arabia, and was sponsored by the Saudi King Abdullah. In that agreement, Hamas have committed itself to all the agreements signed by the Palestinian Authority with Israel, which means indirectly a recognition of the state of Israel to live in peace and security. Because when they recognize, and even more than that, they went further to give Mahmoud Abbas the authority to negotiate with Israel. And I think this is quite an encouraging step from Hamas towards, you know, achieving peace with Israel. But unfortunately, this decision by Hamas was ignored completely by Israel and by the West. In the Arab summit, which was like a couple of weeks later in Riyadh, also Hamas Prime Minister Ismail Haniyeh was sitting right behind Mahmoud Abbas in the Arab summit, when they adopted all Arab leaders that they want to go ahead with the what's so-called the Arab Peace Initiative with Israel, where they would like sit and talk with Israeli in order to achieve peace. They accepted the United Nations resolution, and Arabs for the first time, including Palestinians, were ready to make peace. But this time, unlike previous occasions, you know, when Arabs were not ready, Palestinians were ready, this time the Israelis were not ready at all, because, as you know, the Prime Minister, Olmert, is, I think, the weakest Prime Minister I've seen in many years, if not decades. And as you know, his popularity is just about 2%, so he's not capable of making any decisions, to the extent that his reaction to Arab summit initiative was, let's think about it. So this is the kind of atmosphere we are in, that you don't have now an Israeli leader who is, like, you know, capable of taking the hard decisions to withdraw from West Bank and Gaza, sit with Arabs and tell them we are serious about peace.
What about Condoleezza Rice? What is your assessment of what the U.S. is doing there?
The U.S. Practically, since January, she made many trips to the region, I think about three. But it was very unfortunate that these trips have achieved nothing more than encouraging Mahmoud Abbas and Olmert to keep meeting. And till now, I think there's about four meetings have been taken place in Jerusalem, and they achieved nothing. Everyone in the territories and even in the Arab world knows how the United States administration is extremely engaged in the situation in Iraq. And far from this, I think they don't really expect the administration to make any major progress in the Middle East peace process because of the coming election here in the United States and the commitment and the difficulties the American forces in Iraq are facing today.
What about the effect of the Iraq war on what's happening and with the occupied territories?
I think definitely it has taken the attention of the Arab Israel conflict, and even more than that, you know, this war in terror and the terrorism, which is targeted in New York in 9/11, have really damaged the Palestinian cause. Because if you look back before 9/11, there was a heavy American involvement in the peace process. Clinton was dedicated most of his time to the extent that I don't think that any world leader have visited the White House, in terms of number of visits similar to what Arafat have visited, or the kind of peace talks we had here between Arafat and Israeli leaders. So since that war, you know, the Americans really have concentrated on the war on terror and diverted their attention to causes like in Afghanistan or their troubles with Iraq.
What is it like in Gaza now?
Gaza is a very sad place. It's not a big jail. It's a small jail. It is the crowdest place on earth. And 70% of the population, even more than 70% of the population in Gaza, living under the line of poverty. They are relying heavily on the aids they received from NGOs, from United Nations organization. It's quite sad because the lucky ones within the Palestinian who would be allowed to go and work in Israel. And the number of these people is not more than 10,000. And if you imagine the kind of difficulties they go through, I think it's suffering in itself. These consider the lucky ones because they have to go to work from leaving their houses straight the early hours, 1 or 2 o'clock, so they can get to the Israeli checkpoint at Erez. They will be searched, and by the time they go to the workplace is by 8 o'clock. To go back to their houses, it should be by midnight. So these lucky ones would have to work 20 hours to earn, you know, something to support their families. The others have no hope, have no chances. Salaries since Hamas won the election in January 2000 have not been paid. So practically you are talking about population more than 1.5 million crammed in a very small area, 350 square kilometer. No hope. We have to give the Palestinians some hope. They can stop fighting, they can stop attacking Israel, and then all will live in peace. It's, you know, we only hear about a woman killed in Sidrot, but nobody mentioned how many Palestinians, you know, practically show the footage of Palestinians killed by Israelis every day. It's quite sad thing. And human being is a human being. I feel sorry when I see or hear of an Israeli civilian killed, but also I'm sorry when I hear a Palestinian killed. So if we want to put an end for this suffering, we want to see a very serious able Israeli politician who would come and sit down and take the hard decision. Because I think we are fed up as a Palestinian of going into peace talks. Any Israeli leadership know exactly if we want to have peace with Israel, they can achieve it tomorrow. But they have to take the hard decision.
I want to thank you very much for being with us. Zaki Shahab is author of the book Inside Hamas, The Untold Story of the Militant Islamic Movement. He is the London-based Al Hayat, a newspaper with them, as well as the Arabic TV channel LBC. Thanks very much for joining
us. It's a pleasure to be with you, Amy.
He heads back to London today. Democracy Now!, democracynow.org is our show. When we come back, the publisher of Harper's Magazine, Rick MacArthur, on a secret trade deal that the Democrats and Republicans have arrived at a consensus on in the House. We'll find out about it. Stay with us. Thank you. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. It was an unexpected announcement from Washington, and one many are still trying to figure out. Earlier this month, the White House and Democratic leaders announced they'd reached a historic agreement on trade. It's the first bipartisan economic agreement since Democrats took control of Congress this year. Democrats say they've won guarantees to protect labor rights and environmental standards in all future trade deals, starting with Peru, Panama, Colombia, and South Korea. Labor rights would include union organizing, collective bargaining, and bans on child labor and workplace discrimination. On the environment, countries trading with the U.S. would be forced to comply with existing laws and international accords. But critics say Democratic leaders have fallen far short of what they claim. The negotiations were conducted in near secrecy, and the details haven't been fully disclosed. Criticism has come from many circles: environmentalists, AIDS activists, American labor unions, social movements in countries including Colombia and Peru. Meanwhile, groups representing major U.S. corporations have supported the plan. The U.S. Chamber of Commerce is the world's largest business federation. Chamber President Tom Donahue said, quote, "We are encouraged by assurances that the labor provisions cannot be read to require compliance with International Labor Organization conventions." Democrats are anything but united on the issue. Democratic caucus members are reportedly meeting today about the deal to avoid an internal split that may be hard to overcome as the agreement was announced. The New York Times reported at least half of Democratic Congress members were prepared to oppose it. In such a case, Democratic leaders would be forced to count on Republican support to pass final legislation. As scrutiny grows, Congressmember Charles Rangel, the Democratic chair of the House Ways and Means Committee, defended the deal in an interview Monday with CNN's Lou Dobbs.
The United States trade representatives, when they're negotiating with a foreign country, should not be negotiating as lobbyists for our multinational. When they sit at that table and U.S. is in there, it means that, yes, they're supposed to get a better than fair deal for our businesses, but they have to consider the impact that it's going to have on American jobs, American communities, and American industry. This is now a part of the policy. This policy is going to be in every agreement. If you're talking about Peru, Panama, Korea, or Colombia, this is going to be, and they have to be held accountable, not to the United States.
That was Democratic Congressmember Charles Rangel, chair of the House Ways and Means Committee and lead negotiator on the trade deal. I'm joined now by Rick MacArthur, publisher of Harper's Magazine and author of the book The Selling of Free Trade, NAFTA, Washington, and the Subversion of American Democracy. He joins me here in the Firehouse studio. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Nice to be here.
What is your understanding of this agreement?
Well, my principal understanding is that this is a fundraising gambit by the House leadership, Nancy Pelosi and Charlie Rangel, and Rangel in particular, because he's chairman of the Money Committee, the House Ways and Means Committee, are putting out their sandwich board on Wall Street to say, we're ready for business, we're open for business. We've got to show you something, that we're interested in something you're interested in. Now pony up. This is a fundraising tactic which was pioneered by Bill Clinton in the NAFTA fight in 1993, when he essentially said the Democratic Party, or at least my administration, is going to be a corporate-friendly Democratic Party, and I'm going to prove my bona fides, I'm going to prove my credibility with the business community by pushing a trade agreement that is absolutely hostile to everything that the Democratic Party used to stand for, or that the base of the Democratic Party stands for. Which was NAFTA, which the Business Roundtable loved, which the Fortune 500 loved. And as a result, Clinton was able to raise massive amounts of money from corporate America and from Wall Street that had been hitherto unavailable to the Democratic Party. That was Republican money. Now Rangel and Pelosi are saying, well, we're gearing up for the 2008 election. We've got to raise a lot of money. They're closer to the Clinton wing of the party, which is the pro so-called free trade wing of the party, the pro NAFTA, pro permanent normal trade relations with China part of the party. And this is a way of saying to the corporate community and to Wall Street particularly, and to Walmart, the retail lobby, Wall Street, Walmart, that we're open for business. We want to raise money from you. Now, none of this has to do with the two main trade agreements that are not going to be changed. You didn't see Rangel say they're going to revisit NAFTA and change the rules of NAFTA. That you didn't see him say we're going to do anything about China, because that's where the big money is. That's where the big dislocation has occurred. He's talking about four or three particularly small countries, which, first of all, putting aside whether it's appropriate for the United States to be legislating domestic social improvements in foreign countries, these are unenforceable. The Peruvians, for example, they have nothing to sell us. They have nothing to offer us but cheap labor. So the idea that we're going to be able to, we're going to force the Peruvians to raise labor standards when it's precisely the low labor standards, the lousy labor standards, the lack of environmental control and regulation that attracts people to build factories in Peru in the first place is preposterous. In Colombia, there are 60, I don't know, 70 union organizers murdered every year. It is impossible to control the militias, the right-wing militias, and the government forces in Colombia. The idea that we're going to legislate through a trade agreement to essentially stop the civil war in Colombia is madness. But here you have the leadership saying, we're going to put these big, important conditions in the trade agreement as though they could enforce them. Second thing to remember, of course, is that who's going to do the enforcing? Who's going to do the certifying? The executive branch, the White House, will decide whether Peru or Colombia or Panama are in compliance with these new symbolic provisions. So this is very much a replay of NAFTA in the sense that in NAFTA they also said we're going to have side agreements on labor rights, environmental protection, the National Development Bank along the border. None of it was, virtually none of it was implemented.
I wanted to read a quote from you from Cokie and Steve Roberts. Cokie Roberts, right. Of course, NPR, ABC. They wrote in their column, losers and their labor bosses should not be allowed to dictate trade policy. Congress should shelve its feelings and renew his authority to negotiate more trade deals. America's economic future depends on it.
Right. Well, these are the elites of the media. They're aligned with Wall Street, Walmart, with the leadership of the political parties. And what they're talking about here is fast track, which is a fundamentally undemocratic and, I think, broadly speaking, unconstitutional approach to negotiating trade treaties. And this is why people have to get interested in this now, not a year from now. If Congress authorizes what they call fast track negotiation, that means that the White House is able then to negotiate, or the trade representative, the executive, is permitted to negotiate the treaty, the trade deal with the foreign country, bring it back to Congress, and then there has to be an up or down vote on the whole package, on the whole bill, with no amendments. It's unlike any other legislation that goes through Congress. You're not permitted to amend it. So you can imagine when a fast track negotiated treaty comes back to Congress, there's tremendous pressure on the dissident congressman, saying, look what we've done. We've put side agreements in. We've put in nice things to protect labor organizers in Colombia and Peru. You got to vote for this. And you also got to do it because if you want to stay, remain an important member of the Democratic Party caucus, you'd better vote for it. And then you can't, and there's no way you can amend it.
Hillary Clinton was on the Walmart board for years.
Six years, from 1986 to 1992. Hillary Clinton was on the board of Walmart. I keep trying to explain to people that Walmart is not a public service organization, that they're in the business of making money. They're also in the business of maintaining these relationships with dedicated factories in China, particularly, where you cannot form a labor union independent of the all-Chinese labor federation, which is controlled by the government. Wildcat strikes are met with violence. You get your head busted or you get thrown in jail. And I also wish people would understand the same situation. It's not as disciplined or as rigid in Mexico, but it's still largely the case that if you try to start a labor union, an independent labor union that is independent of the CTM, the National Labor Union, which has historically been a subsidiary of the Mexican government, you get your head busted. You get thrown out. You get intimidated. You're lucky if you have the CTM in a plant, but if you actually have the guts to form your own union, you're risking your life. Charlie Rangel is not talking about Mexico. He's not talking about China. He's talking about these little countries that are going to have very little impact, but which we will then be able to exploit more efficiently. Because trade agreements, first of all, these trade agreements are contracts. They're investment agreements. Their main purpose is to protect American investment or foreign investment in these countries against expropriation, against seizure of assets, so that they can not only operate safely in terms of an investment platform, but also lock in the cheap labor.
How did the Democrats get away with negotiating this in secret the way they have? And how much of this have we seen at this point?
Well, this is the legacy of the Clinton administration, that the Clintons persuaded enough members of the Democratic Party that labor unions were finished, and they were, I think, largely right. Labor unions were finished as an important source of votes and power, or that they could be taken for granted. They were going to vote for the Democrats anyway because they had no choice. And the place to raise money and to expand influence with the party was in corporate America. And Clinton says to these people, through Terry McAuliffe and all his friends, Gene Sperling, the corporate Democrats who came out of the Democratic Leadership Council, look, you can't argue with results. I got elected president twice, and we almost had fundraising parity with the Republicans in the 90s.
Now, and so what power do the pressure groups like unions, like environmental groups have right now? We have 30 seconds.
Well, they have to say, we're not going to play along with this anymore. We're not going to act as a subsidiary of the Democratic Party. And they've got to put pressure on the newly elected members of Congress, the Sherrod Browns from Ohio, the Jim McGoverns from Massachusetts. He's not new, but Sherrod Brown in the Senate is a better example. Don't give in to these fake symbolic gestures toward labor rights. They're just window dressing. They're just fig leaves to cover up what the real agenda is, which is to, again, give corporations more choices of cheap labor countries to operate in, which kill unions in the United States, because you can't organize a union in this country anymore. Can't do it, because they'll shut your plant down or they'll threaten to shut your plant down.
We're going to have to leave it there. Rick MacArthur, thank you very much. Publisher of Harper's Magazine, author of the book The Selling of Free Trade, NAFTA, Washington, and the Subversion of American Democracy. And that does it for the broadcast. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Berkshire, Bill Caduce, John Hamilton, Elizabeth Press, Aaron Matei, Mike DeFilippo, Nick Marsilio, Miguel Noguera, our engineers. Special thanks to Becca Staley, Elizabeth Press, Samantha Chambly, Kieran Krug-Meadows. Our website is democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.